KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Police John Diaz released their own reform list. One item on the list is to recruit great officers. The goal is to recruit officers who are educated and ethnically diverse and who understand cultural values. McGinn is scheduled to make his announcement this morning at El Centro de la Raza. A shift in winds today is helping firefighters at a couple of wildfires in southwest Washington. Department of Natural Resources spokeswoman Karen Ripley says they grew Sunday under dry easterly winds, but winds have shifted to an onshore flow, bringing cooler, more humid air. About 100 firefighters with helicopters are trying to control a fire that's burned about 100 acres near the eastern end of Rife Lake in Lewis County. It's burning debris in a recently logged area. Another fire has burned about 60 acres of logging debris in the Capitol Forest near Little Rock in Thurston County. Firefighters are mopping up smaller fires near Tenino and La Center. After the hot, sunny weekend in Washington, forecasters say the fair weather should continue most of the week. The National Weather Service says clouds will move into western Washington by Tuesday and Wednesday, but high temperatures will stay and in the 70s. Sunny skies should return Thursday and continue until Sunday, when a chance of rain returns to the forecast. In eastern Washington, forecasters expect sunny skies and highs in the 80s until Thursday, when above normal temperatures will melt mountain snow and cause many rivers to rise. This is KUOW News. I'm Jamala Henderson.
Currently in Seattle, 67 degrees under a clear blue sky. Forecast calls for sun all day with an afternoon high of 84. Support for NPR comes from the Pajamagram Company, offering women's pajamas in gift packaging delivered overnight and for Mother's Day at pajamagram.com. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:06. KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle and KUOW.org, I'm Marcy Silman. The Washington State Legislature will reconvene next Monday for a special legislative session. The regular session ended April 28th. Most of the regular business was left unfinished when the adjournment happened. We're going to take a look at pre-session wrangling with Everett Herald Olympia correspondent Jerry Kornfield. That's coming up just after 10 o'clock. Also coming up next hour, librarian extraordinaire Nancy Pearl. So stay with us this morning. We turn our attentions now to legislative wrangling in the other Washington state. And joining us to look ahead at the week in Congress is Jill Jackson, a frequent guest on the show. She's Capitol Hill news producer for CBS News. Nice to speak with you. It's been a long time.
Thanks, Marcy. Nice to speak with you.
All right. So for us in Seattle, we've still got our annual May Day rally and mayhem on our minds. Immigration rights was the subject, and I know the Senate Judiciary Committee is going to be taking up the immigration bill this week, right?
That's right. This week will be the first chance to essentially kill the immigration reform bill for those who are opposed to the Gang of Eight's compromise bill. The committee will take it up. It's an 844-page bill, and basically lawmakers will be able to introduce amendments and change the package. That means there are potentially numerous options with those amendments to put in poison pills or language that could cause the Gang of Eight itself to fall apart, or for something that could truly prohibit conservative support. For example, the chairman, Senator Patrick Leahy from Vermont, is expected to introduce an amendment that would allow same-sex couples to be eligible for the same green card privileges that that hetero couples have right now. That means automatically you could get a green card if you were part of a same-sex couple. The Republicans in the Gang of Eight have said that will absolutely kill the bill, but a lot of liberal Democrats say it's something that is critical to them supporting the bill. That being said, the White House has said while they'd like to see that provision in the bill, they're not saying it's a necessity for them to sign the package. And the chairman himself, Patrick Leahy, says he doesn't think it will bring down the package, but we will have to see. Then another issue that I expect to be discussed a lot is visa exit entry programs in light of the Boston bombings. You had a case of a visa overstayer with one of the friends of the Boston bombers. You have one Senator, Lindsey Graham, who's part of the Gang of Eight, wanting expanded background checks for those who may be high risk, saying that maybe that's something that could apply to the that could have applied to the Tsarnaev brothers. So it's going to touch on a lot of issues and will be very thorny, and I imagine the work could go this week and maybe even into next week.
How important is Marco Rubio to passage of this bill?
Marco Rubio is absolutely critical. He is the freshman senator from Florida. He is a Tea Party favorite. He has the trust of many Republican conservative talk show hosts, and he is considered the one, the linchpin, sort of keeping the Gang of Eight's immigration proposal together. He himself is a Cuban American, and the Republicans just trust him. When he says that he supports something, he definitely brings members along. And if he's able to succeed along with the Gang of Eight in keeping this package together in the Senate to the point where it passes, then it will head over to the House. And once again, Marco Rubio's reputation means something to the House conservatives, a lot of them Tea Party in the House, and could give it some momentum over in the House, though it's going to be a much tougher slog there, just because of the more conservative elements.
If you were a betting woman, would you place odds on this bill passing or being defeated?
I think that I covered the last major attempt at comprehensive immigration reform in Congress, and that went down. But this time, the difference is that a lot of Republicans see this as in their political interest, having seen the Hispanic vote just absolutely swarm to the Democratic side, and seeing sort of the future demographics in this country of just becoming a more diverse nation, the rise of the Hispanic communities. They see that if they want to be viable politically in the future, especially winning the White House, they're going to need to be more attractive to the Hispanic community. And a lot of Republicans see this as an opportunity to do that. So I think that something absolutely could happen, but the question is, will it be this major, huge, comprehensive overhaul that we're seeing in the Senate, nearly 1,000 pages, or will it be something more like what House Republicans are saying they want, which is, piece by piece, smaller solutions, maybe an ag program here, visa reforms there, doing them in just more of a piecemeal approach so that members have an opportunity to vote for certain things and against other things, specifically that thorny issue that always comes, always is the big trick, and that's the path to citizenship, which the Senate bill does include.
We're talking with Jill Jackson of CBS News, looking ahead at the week in Washington, D.C., and the sort of, I don't want to call it a stalemate, but the stalled progress on U.S. involvement in Syria. I'm not sure if it got a kick in the pants or a big red light this weekend when Israel bombed Syria, but I'm assuming that that kind of catapulted what the U.S. is going to do in that civil war up to the forefront of some people's agendas.
Absolutely. Our understanding is that the White House is now considering they're going to make a decision in the next couple weeks on what sort of action to take in Syria. And they've gone back and forth on what to do, especially in light of reports that that Syria used chemical weapons on its own people. But it's a thorny issue, and one that even congressional Republicans are torn on. We had on the Sunday talk show host Congressman Pete King, who is the former chair of the Homeland Security Committee, saying he worries about arming the Syrian rebels, because after the Assad regime topples, it could mean that those weapons end up in the hands of al-Qaeda extremists. That's something that no one would want. But then you have others, like Congressman Tom Cotton, who said that the United States should get as involved to the point where they should arm the opposition and even create a no-fly zone in Syria. Chairman of the Intelligence Committee, Mike Rogers, he is also he's been a long proponent for providing more intelligence and training to the rebels on the ground, and possibly some sort of no-fly zone using advanced technology rather than planes, but that part is rather vague. So you have really a lot of people saying that the administration should do many different things. The one thing that everyone does seem to agree on is that there should be no U.S. boots on the ground.
Well, it's interesting. We were speaking to the Christian Science Monitor's Syria correspondent last week. He had just gotten back from Aleppo. And as you just mentioned, he said that, the rebel factions are so diverse, and some of them do have direct ties to al-Qaeda, some of them don't. But he said what he was hearing from citizenry was this kind of puzzlement, like, where is the United States in all of this? And seeming to think that they were at the point where they were thinking, well, it's conspiracy. The United States is trying to keep Assad in power. So it's messy either way. It's just kind of one of you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of situations.
It's very messy. And I think that there's a wariness in terms of on the administration side and from many congressional Democrats in terms of the intelligence we're getting out of Syria, because a lot of them felt burned by the intelligence going into the Iraq war. So there's just a lot of timidity on the side of Democrats and even the administration wanting to do the right thing that will actually help the situation rather than put everyone in the region in greater danger in the future.
Well, you mentioned intelligence. I know on Wednesday the Oversight and Government Reform Committee is going to have another hearing on the Benghazi Libya attacks. And people may remember that the embassy was attacked. The ambassador, Chris Stevens, was killed along with three other Americans in that attack. Republicans have been charging ahead with this investigation, saying that intelligence officials, or at least foreign service officials, knew more than they let on originally.
That's right. And we expect to hear from whistleblowers at the hearing on Wednesday. The top U.S. diplomat under Chris Stevens in Libya, Gregory Hicks, is expected to testify that from the get-go, they knew it was a terrorist attack on the Benghazi compound and that there were al-Qaeda-influenced elements involved in it. He told investigators on the House Oversight Government Reform Committee in an interview that there was no demonstration outside the compound in Benghazi, as the Obama administration claimed, and that he does not know why they claimed that. He said that their actions that directly contradicted what the Libyan president was saying about Islamist extremists being involved hurt the investigation afterwards in terms of getting the FBI on the ground in Benghazi, and is very critical of their response. I would also expect at that hearing more scrutiny of the talking points that the CIA prepared for members of Congress and were used by UN Ambassador Susan Rice on the Sunday political shows. They claimed that it was an offensive video that insulted Muslims that sparked a protest in Egypt, and then that basically spurred on these protests in Benghazi. Well, the Weekly Standard obtained over the weekend different drafts of the actual talking points, and it shows that references to Islamist extremists with ties to al-Qaeda and five smaller attacks that had happened previously on the compound in Benghazi, those references to those things were struck from the talking points after they reported State Department spokeswoman Victoria Nuland objected to the wording, saying that it could lead Congress to accuse the State Department of ignoring security threats in Benghazi. So this, again, is a messy situation. It's one that really is pitting the Republicans in Congress against the administration. But you even have some Democrats, like Congressman Stephen Lynch, who said yesterday that these talking points were scrubbed. So there's a lot of concern over that. Expect more scrutiny and definitely high criticism of the administration.
Aside from pointing the finger and shaming the administration, is there any further action that would be taken? I guess what I'm asking is, maybe you want to get to the bottom of this, but is the aim really just to throw mud in the eye of the Obama administration, or is there some preventive measure that comes out of all of this?
I certainly think that mud in the eye of the administration is definitely one aim. But I also think that there's an element of getting to the bottom of this. The State Department, when they did their own review of what happened, didn't really place the blame on anyone at the State Department. And I think that Republicans think that there should be some culpability, that there should be some blame, that someone's responsible, and that if there isn't, then things like this could happen again in the future. So there is that element. Now, of course, there is also a political element, and that is that during the Benghazi attacks and the immediate aftermath and reaction, while state was reacting to the attacks, the Secretary of State was Hillary Clinton, and we know that everyone is eyeing her for a possible 2016 run. So if there is great damage done to her as this investigation unfolds, that definitely could have political implications down the line.
And finally, we turn back to something domestic, which is something that Amazon here has long opposed and has reversed its position on. Congress is going to be looking at finally putting into effect, or at least opening the door to, an internet sales tax. And this is something for years Amazon opposed. They've reversed their position. I know there are lawsuits pending in several states, at least several. Is this a go? You think that this is something that we're going to see?
We are expecting that the a final vote on that could come in the Senate as early as today. There will definitely be a key vote on it today, and it's expected to pass. The question, though, is, will it actually go anywhere in the House of Representatives? It's a tax, and that's something that House Republicans are certainly against. And so it's going to be a tough slog in the House of Representatives. So far, from talks I've had with some more conservative Republicans, there has not been much appetite for this bill at all. That being said, the others see this as a good source of revenue for the states at a time when they're still hurting. And so the question is, will it get the momentum? But it's certainly not going to be a sure thing in the House of Representatives. And I can tell you that we've seen a lot of opposition, especially from states like Oregon and New Hampshire, that don't have a sales tax at all and are very concerned about adding that at this time.
Something interesting to watch. Well, Jill, I thank you so much for taking time to at least give us a tip of the iceberg about what's happening on your side of the country. Have a good week.
Thanks, Marcy.
Jill Jackson is Capitol Hill News producer for CBS News. This is Weekday.
'922. Remembering the American composer Charles Ives in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Laird Norton Wealth Management, celebrating 75 years of King County Parks by establishing the King County Parks Foundation, devoted to strengthening families and connecting communities for generations to come. Information on contributing at ourparksourfuture.org.
68 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 84 this afternoon with lots of sun. Overnight, it'll be partly cloudy, low of 53. Tomorrow, Tuesday, some clouds in the morning, then partly sunny in the afternoon, and a high of 72. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:23. Some advice on how to behave politely in this modern digital world in 15 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. This week, the University of Washington will kick off a festival that celebrates the music of the American composer Charles Ives. We were curious, and to find out more, we set loose our own cellist in residence, Dave Beck, who joins me in the studio. Hi, Dave. Nice to have you in here.
Good morning, Marcy. Nice to see you.
Okay, so I've heard Charles Ives, but I'm thinking Currier and Ives. Who is Charles Ives' composer?
Well, he was the great maverick American composer who lived from 1874 to 1954, and he grew up in the small town of Danbury, Connecticut, and his music education, interesting, came from his father, George, who was a Civil War bandmaster. So very traditional in certain ways, but he would do things with his son, Charlie, and say, Charlie, I'm going to sit down at the piano here and play Yankee Doodle say in the key of C, I want you to sing it back to me in the key of E flat. So is this all idea of, yes, root in tradition, but think outside the box. And Larry Starr, who's a music historian here at the UW, a great Ives expert and organizer of this festival, says that Ives really was the original out-of-the-box thinker when it came to American music.
So we're going to hear a little bit of music, but I'm curious because what's famous is something called the Concord Piano Sonata.
Right. So the Ives Festival actually kicks off this afternoon at 1:30, public lecture by Joseph Horowitz, who's a great scholar of American music. And then one of the pieces that Larry Starr has put on the program is the Concord. It was written between 1911 and 1915, and it pays homage to the New England transcendentalist writers. There's a
wow.
Emerson, yes, heady stuff. Emerson, Thoreau, Hawthorne, the Alcotts are all names of the movements, and it does everything from, you know, there's these little ragtime marches to this very out there dissonant, you know, tone clusters. Everything finds a place in this piece called The Concord, and it's just a great representation of what Ives did and how he thought as a musician.
So you brought Larry Starr in and a pianist?
Yes. Christina Valdez, a great pianist, specializes in contemporary works, and she's going to play the Concord Sonata this week as part of the festival. Again, the festival is today through Wednesday. We'll have stuff at the website of all the different events. But she came into our performance studio along with Larry to kind of break down the Concord for us. And Larry Starr began the conversation by talking about how he discovered Ives in the first place.
This is sort of a nice family story, which Ives would have appreciated because he was very much a family man and had a very deep regard for his father, who taught Ives a lot of what he knew about music. The story I'm going to tell you also contradicts very conveniently two legends about Ives. I mean, the one is that he's an impossible modernist and not accessible. And the second thing is that, you know, you have to know the hymn tunes and the marching bands and everything that Ives grew up with in order to understand his pieces. The first contact I remember having with Ives was over the radio in New York City. And this was at the time when there actually was more than one classical music station on the radio. And they played a variety of things. They sometimes played Ives instead of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony or Appalachian Spring, which, you know, here is sort of a headline event when that happens. But I didn't know any Ives at all. I happened to be listening with my father, and Ives's piece Putnam's Camp came on, which is an evocation of a 4th of July celebration in Danbury, complete with town bands, many of which are playing at the same time in different keys, and just a kind of an informal sense of what a town musical celebration would sound like. And my father and I had no proper preparation for, you know, appreciating Ives at all. We couldn't tell you a Protestant hymn tune from Yankee Doodle. We were metropolitan New Yorkers, you know, with no connections to old New England families, you know, Protestant heritage or anything like that. And we heard Putnam's Camp, and we were both slapping each other on the back and literally rolling on the floor, thinking it was the most amazing, wonderful, crazy music we'd ever heard. And who was this man, Charles Ives?
So it was, did you connect through the humor, or what was the commonality you felt there?
Putnam's Camp expresses the sheer joy in music making, it seems to me. The explosion of activity that would surround a 4th of July in a small town where all kinds of musical things are going on, and the sense that it really doesn't matter if things are neat, that it is the spirit that came through. And this is what came through immediately to my father and myself.
Mm-hmm. So Ives was feisty and irascible and very much prone to go his own way with things. Yet one of the ideas you want to emphasize in the Ives Festival that you've produced is the idea of community. It seems a little paradoxical. What attracted you to that idea?
Well, you see, the deepest paradox that surrounds Ives is he's regarded as this loner in the world. And it's true. I mean, as a composer, he was isolated because working as a businessman in Midtown Manhattan, he felt quite accurately, I think, that there was no immediate audience in the classical music world at that time for the music that he wanted to write. And so he did keep it to himself. But the music is anything but that of a sort of an abstract isolationist in music. The music is full of evocations of popular music, church hymns, all kinds of community music, which Ives wrote into this, and I think it expresses a composer his longing for a community that he didn't have. Mm-hmm. In a sense, he took his experience with musical community, made it an idea that he wrote into his compositions, and presented it to us in the future as an ideal of what a musical community can sound like. The music so reaches out, it seems to me, to a community. We see this in his fondness of what I would call open endings, you know, pieces that do not formally conclude in a neat, conventional way, but leave the listener something to work on and think about. This is true of the endings of so many songs, which end with questions or incomplete sentences. This is a man who is reaching out for a community that he doesn't have, but is imagining and wishes he did have.
We talk about this role of community, and how did the idea or ideal of Beethoven fit into that idea with Ives?
Well, Beethoven, I think, was Ives' model, as he regarded him as the greatest composer. Mm-hmm. And Beethoven's music had entered the world community, certainly, by the time Ives was writing. So his evocation of Beethoven is yet another way of evoking a different aspect of community. This is our communal experience. The four-note motive of Beethoven's sonata resonates with anyone, you know, who's had the most elementary kind of musical training. You know, I will use that and bring that into my imagined musical community as mm-hmm. well, along with hymn tunes, along with modernism. Ives embraced the idea that these things could coexist within a single piece, which is what distinguishes him from most of his European contemporaries, this sort of, I'm going to embrace the world, which is very American. You know, it's Walt Whitman-esque. You know, Ives probably would have said, you know, well, how can you have a C major cadence and this atonal material? And he might have said, as Whitman did, you know, do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes. You know?
Emerson is by far the most difficult movement of this piece, I think, both as a performer and as a listener, and it's incredibly dense, and all of the information for all of the motives and the themes and the core of what makes the entire sonata is all present there in that very first page. And the figure that is the most striking is the Beethoven, bop, 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 bum, which we really experience throughout the whole piece. And it's almost the transformation of that motive is symbolic of the transformation that one goes through in their experience of this entire piece, whether you're coming at it from the performer or the audience perspective. It's a truly transcendent experience that occurs.
Christina Valdez, live in our performance studio here at KUOW with some of the Beethoven that works its way into the Charles Ives Concord Sonata. She's going to be performing that as part of the Festival of Ives that's happening at the University of Washington May 6th through 8th. We're talking with Christina and the organizer of that festival, University of Washington music historian and professor Larry Starr. Help us understand, Larry Starr, why Concord, Massachusetts was the place that Ives was attracted to and why he wanted to set...
Well, I think it relates to his incredible identification with the spirit of transcendentalism that is associated with the Concord writers, most particularly and obviously Emerson and Thoreau, but he also links Hawthorne to that and the Alcott family more through the father, Bronson Alcott, than through the daughters necessarily who wrote the famous books. But still a sense that this was where the spirit of transcendentalism flourished in 19th century America. And Ives identified very much with the spiritual aspiration of transcendentalism.
Mm-hmm. So as the piece goes on, there's this movement called the Alcotts. Larry makes reference to that literary family. And there's this weaving together of Beethoven and church hymns in this movement. What kind of picture is Ives painting in music here with this Alcott movement? What is he up to here?
It's his domestic movement, I would say. It's evoking a family around the piano, playing Beethoven, singing hymns. And this is we might say, the domestic spirit of transcendentalism, the family unity aspiring around, on the one hand, the respect for great art, and on the other hand, you know, the humble music of the church, both being a kind of community for the family, yeah. If that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And this movement is so in contrast with the others, much gentler and lyrical. And
very much so. I think domestic is sort of the perfect word for it. And Ives, as Larry had mentioned, was attracted to the hymn that this is based on because it has the same motive of Beethoven's Fifth. But obviously it sounds very different in this context here. So when the movement begins, you may think that what you're hearing is another iteration of that Beethoven Fifth motive, but then you quickly realize that, no, this is actually something else, that there's been a transformation. And about the Alcott's family, again, in his notes, he describes it best when he's referring to hearing what's going on in the house. And he says, "And there sits the little old spinet piano Sophia Thoreau gave to the Alcott children, on which Beth played the old Scotch airs and played at the Fifth Symphony."
Played at the Fifth Symphony. I wonder what he says to audiences today. How does Ives resonate with us, you know, in our contemporary lives?
I can only answer for myself, really, although I've seen this with students and other people. Ives's music, by remaining relatively unconventional, even in the postmodern era, by refusing to stay within a frame, by reaching out to embrace the whole musical universe, challenges us to get out of our own ruts of thinking about art only a certain way, of music only a certain way, of behaving only a certain way, to look outside the box. I mean, Ives is a composer who would never fit into any box, I think encourages us as listeners to think outside our own boxes. Mm-hmm. And so many of the pieces, this is true of the Concord Sonata, by the way, end with seemingly an open question, not a conventional cadence or even a conventional finishing gesture, but one that sort of reaches out to the audience and says, well, think about this, now what? On one of his pieces, Ives actually wrote something that could serve very well as an ending point, an ending message for just about any piece he wrote. He wrote, "Good place to stop, not end."
And I think that's a perfect way to wrap up our conversation. We wish you well on this upcoming Festival of Ives.
Thank you, Dave.
That was KUOW's Dave Beck speaking with Larry Starr, University of Washington music historian and organizer of the UW's Festival of Ives. Christina Valdez was the pianist in Ives' Concord Sonata. Doug Patterson mixed the music in our performance studio. The Ives Festival begins today and runs through Wednesday at the University of Washington. We've got information at kuow.org.
It's 9:38. Digital etiquette in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Washington Academy of Languages, a division of CityU, providing foreign language learning opportunities to the Seattle community since 1979. Learn more online at wal.org.
Explain aloud just what you're doing.
Radioactive is a journalism training program for youth ages 16 to 18.
We have some pretty great stories for you.
Summer applications are now open.
So tune in.
If you dare.
Apply online by May 13th at kuow.org/radioactive.
Support for KUOW comes from Nissan and the 100% electric Nissan Leaf, whose drivers have driven more than 150 million miles gas-free. More at NissanUSA.com.
69 degrees in Seattle under a clear blue sky, expecting sun all day with an afternoon high of 84. Going to be considerably less warm than that tomorrow, though. Tomorrow, Tuesday, the predicted high is 72 and only partly sunny.
Support for KUOW comes from Emirates, offering daily nonstop service from Seattle to Dubai and on to over 130 destinations worldwide. More at emirates.com/USA. Fly Emirates. Hello tomorrow.
The huge wildfire in Southern California does not appear to be the product of arson. That's what investigators are saying. And firefighters are finally getting a handle on that blaze thanks to some cooperation from the weather. A full update in 20 minutes.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. The internet might seem like the perfect forum for anything goes behavior, but there is an etiquette to how and when we use it. Daniel Post-Senning is the manager of web development and online content at the Emily Post Institute. He's the great-great-grandson of Emily Post, the American etiquette writer, and he's written a new book. It's called Manners in a Digital World. It's a book of guidance for technophiles and technophobes alike. He recently talked to Steve Scher about the book and what his great-great-grandma might think about the new technologies and netiquette.
Emily herself was an early adopter. She had a radio program that was incredibly popular. She loved her dictaphone. She called it Susie. At the time, that was a remarkable new technological device. She articulated manners for the party lines that were installed in people's homes during her lifetime. Emily was intrigued with youth culture and with new technology. She was fascinated with human relationship, and anything that served human relationship, she took interest in. And I'm absolutely convinced if Emily was alive today, she would be enamored with social media, new technology, mobile devices.
But what was her nature? Would she have rules for etiquette, which would clearly be transported into the digital world?
Absolutely.
What would they be?
So the fundamental principles that we've identified at the Institute that really are the underpinning of all good etiquette from our perspective are consideration, respect, and honesty. So those things really don't change. The specific manners will take different form around them, but treating other people the way we'd want to be treated, thinking about others, thinking about how our actions impact and affect others, that's really the heart of the matter, has been and will continue to be.
All right. So in terms of the lessons learned, with that in mind, in terms of lessons learned, what do you tell people when they are asking you about something like Facebook, which has already established itself, which already sort of has rules, there are privacy settings people can understand? What are the new emergent problems for an individual with Facebook?
Sure. The biggest issue we hear about Facebook is the problem of oversharing. Just not being critically aware of who an audience is and how appropriate it is to share a certain piece of information. Sometimes the overshare is just too much volume, just too much to all the time. It makes it difficult for other people to sort out what's important. The other kind of overshare is just information that's too personal, too private to go up in that kind of a public forum. So oversharing, probably the biggest one on Facebook, and most people are starting to understand how to manage privacy settings. They're making choices about if they use their Facebook for family and friends, not letting colleagues join their Facebook page, or keeping a version of their Facebook that's professionally appropriate. Those are some of the new standards that are emerging in the Facebook world in particular.
I also noticed you brought in LinkedIn on this. LinkedIn is a little more is a little newer, and it's got a little different tone. And yet, you're finding, what are you finding, that people don't see the borders with LinkedIn?
Sometimes, although the cliche about LinkedIn is you can think of it as your online resume. You can think of it as a professional networking social media site. And people have really embraced it as that. LinkedIn went public a couple years ago. And I think the process of going public as a company really helped them. Their platform got juicier. They started to add more features. And frankly, I really liked it. I thought it was an upgrade for the site, some of the work they've done on LinkedIn over the last few years. And I think the professional communities really responded. HR departments are using LinkedIn to conduct searches these days. It's definitely the recommended social media network for professionals.
Yeah, are there problems with it, or is it a place where people can be pretty confident in what they're seeing and what they're posting?
Well, you definitely want to give people that confidence. And one of the places people get in some trouble on LinkedIn is when they treat their professional network like it's a social network. Maybe they've automated that their Twitter feed also feeds their Facebook page and their LinkedIn page. But the content from your Twitter account might be appropriate for Facebook sometimes. It might rarely be appropriate for LinkedIn. So as the features and the capacities of LinkedIn continue to grow and increase, being seduced or tricked or just sort of cajoled into thinking of that as a place where you can operate socially with more freedom might be a trap for some people who really like that aspect of social media, but it's not so appropriate there.
You know, given how widespread all these various platforms are, who doesn't know these things? Who's at risk here of wandering into a morass?
New users are the obvious first choice. And these days we've got more and more. The new user doesn't always look like what you imagine. It's not always the teen who's getting online for the first time. More and more it's seniors, it's elders in our world who are getting online, discovering these new communication tools. Sometimes it's someone like my father who's recently retired and decided he's going to take the plunge and get his first iPad. He programmed computers for 30 years, but that was all DOS systems. So the new user, but also we all need to participate in a regular process of assessing our habits, that this environment is changing so rapidly. Things that served us as specific behaviors maybe even 6 months ago might not be the best behavior 6 months from now when Facebook's changed their privacy settings. So a willingness to relearn what we've learned is important even for those of us that feel really facile with this stuff.
Daniel Post-Senning is author of Manners in a Digital World, Living Well Online. Has that happened? Do you have an example of that where even those of us who think we know what's happening have seen something change and been surprised by it in the last few months?
Oh, boy. You know, I think that the changing privacy settings on Facebook is a great example of that. Usually, they're going the route of giving people more and more control over their own profile. But a couple months ago, they did do a step that went, some people's perspective, in the other direction when they opened up more and more personal information of users to advertisers. If you didn't go in and opt out of allowing your photos or information to be made public in those ways, maybe there was stuff that you had put up previously that all of a sudden was available to a slightly wider range of people with a slightly different set of goals and objectives than maybe the people that you originally intended to be the audience for that information.
Let's talk about photos, because photos are where a lot of people are getting in trouble, in part because of those privacy settings, in part because a photo of me can be put up by somebody else, and all of a sudden what I didn't know was public was public. How do I control for that? And what should the poster understand?
Part of what I would love to come out of publishing this book is to participate and to contribute to a larger discussion about discretion and the role of discretion, a sense of personal privacy in terms of how we all operate online. Whenever we're making decisions about ourselves, I like to tell people to cultivate the rule of two. If you have a little voice in your head that's saying, am I going too far? Is this a little too much? You want to defer to that voice. When you're making a decision that impacts someone else, that goes double or fivefold or tenfold. You really want to think carefully. If there's any hesitation in your mind, you know, would this reflect badly on this person? Might this person be hurt or feel awkward if someone saw this or if they saw it and were surprised to see it in this setting? And that you take extra caution when you think about making those choices for other people. So that's my broad concept for thinking about it. But what do you do if it's happened to you? If you see a picture up that you think is unflattering or inappropriate, you can untag yourself immediately and you can contact the person and ask them to take it down. Those are two common and very realistic, doable steps that almost anybody can do to address that kind of a situation.
You know, you use the word discretion. How does discretion fit into the internet?
Well, more and more. It's part of the discussion. I tell people that when it came to first setting up a social media profile, I had to overcome a natural New England modesty. And I think that was the case for a lot of people. Something felt a little indelicate or indiscreet about putting aspects of ourselves up online in such public ways. As we started collectively as a larger community to cross that threshold and get more and more comfortable putting stuff up online, the pendulum swings. I think we're at a stage now where the pendulum's starting to swing back and we're starting to ask ourselves, the we being the royal we, the collective community that creates and maintains these spaces, do we really want everything out there? Do we want to be making choices about it? Something that I think is illuminating is that one of the most popular messaging services for people under the age of 25 is Snapchat. The appeal behind Snapchat is that the message that you send is supposedly destroyed automatically a certain period of time after you send it. So there's not some permanent archived record of every discussion that you have. For younger users, that's important. They want that ability to have the discussion, to be a little more discreet about it, to not have a permanent record of it available.
Isn't that interesting? That's an interesting shift in how we think about the web. Do you think that's the way it should go, so that we can be free, we can spout off, because we'll know it'll disappear?
It's the classic, with rights come responsibilities. The answer to every good either-or question is both. And really finding that balance, striking that balance, maintaining that balance is all of our jobs. And I can think about so many ways that these questions emerge. Another is the separation of work life and home life. If you've got a cell phone at your desk that your kids can call you at any hour of the day, similarly, that phone comes home with you at night and your boss or your coworkers can reach you when you're at home with your family. How we strike the balance, establish boundaries in our lives, become challenges for all of us, and things that were predetermined before are now things that we need to make critical choices about.
Daniel Post-Senning is author of Manners in a Digital World. Well, you write about trolls. You write about people's tendency to want to be unpleasant and egregious in their statements about others. That's what the web offers, is anonymity about those things. You're asking people to be polite and respectful. Mm-hmm. Those people are often overwhelmed by the impolite and the disrespectful. And that's why people have don't go to the web or abandon some of these sites. Mm-hmm. Why should they come back?
It might seem counterintuitive, but I love talking about trolls. In so many ways, they're the exception that proves the rule. One of the premises that I like to operate on, and it was something that certainly came out in a lot of the discussions in New England about the incident in Boston recently, that the number of people of goodwill in the world, the number of people of good intent, just so outweigh the number of people with bad. Very few people wake up in the morning and say, you know, I'm going to head out there and make someone's day a little worse today. I'm going to go be rude to someone and leave them feeling just a little worse than before they met me. Trolls are the exception. They are the person who does that. They are the exception that proves the rule, and they are so infuriating and so aggravating because they come out and their intent is to disrupt. I tell people one of the new courtesies that's really firmly emerged in digital spaces, online spaces, is that as online citizens, it's important that we don't give those trolls the attention that they're seeking. However inflammatory they appear, they're really there to stir stuff up. They're there to get a reaction. They're not there to have a good argument. They're not there to be convinced. You're not going to make any headway arguing with these people. The best thing to do really is ignore them. If you're a forum moderator and what they're doing is so disruptive, you can delete the comments, you can isolate them, sequester them in a way that they're not disruptive to the other discussion. But almost the worst thing you can do is engage, however tempting it might be.
If this world that you talk of could be modified to get more proper, respectful manners on the web, what's the web going to look like in 5 years?
Oh, boy. I wouldn't dare to presume. The changes that are going on in that space is both technologically and socially are happening so fast that it's really hard to anticipate what that next thing is going to be. Although I'm starting to see it already, the question of as these devices get smaller and more bionic, and the relationship between the digital spaces, the social media spaces, and the devices that we use to interact with them gets subtler. So imagine your Google Glass that's got a screen that's giving you information based on facial recognition of the person you're talking to, or a chip that sits just inside your ear that works the way your cell phone does now, turns your jawbone into a microphone, it can pick up sound, it can transmit sound. Are you supposed to tell someone you're in a meeting with that you're able to take a cell phone call from a phone that they don't know exists? I'm really fascinated at the next level, the next wave of etiquette questions that are going to come as the devices that we interact with these spaces become more and more bionic and more personal.
But it seems like the same rules should apply, shouldn't they? They would be the rules you started with.
Absolutely. And that's one of the great things about wrestling with new questions, but operating from a perspective that has some traditional awareness, that the rules that served my great-great-grandmother almost 100 years ago in many ways will serve to guide us in these new spaces and environments.
That's Daniel Post, Senior Manager of Web Development and Online Content at the Emily Post Institute. He's the great-great-grandson of Emily Post and co-author of the book Emily Post's Etiquette 18th Edition, Manners for a New World. His latest book is Manners in the Digital World. And as you heard, he talked with Steve Scher. Several high school students spent the spring learning how to make radio stories here at KUOW, part of our youth radio program, Radio Active. They worked with producers and editors and learned the basics of radio reporting, and some really great stories came out of that project. You can listen to them all at KUOW.org. We're going to share one of them with you today. Alyssa Cruz is a junior at Inglemore High School in Kenmore. She says one of the best things that ever happened to her is a rare disease that changed her life. Radioactive's Nolwenn Dalil has the story.
One day in eighth grade, Alyssa Cruz noticed something strange.
I was in the middle of a basketball season, and I was putting my hair up, and I noticed that there is this windy, bald patch on the top right of my head. And it looked like it was completely smooth, and I wondered what had happened because it didn't look like someone just cut it off while I was sleeping.
When she saw this, Alyssa went home and showed her parents. They took her to 10 different doctors until she found the one that could help her. The doctor diagnosed her with alopecia universalis. This condition causes Alyssa to lose all the hair on her body, including her arms, her legs, her eyebrows, and even her eyelashes. But it doesn't cause her any other kind of harm. Alyssa's scalp was injected with steroids, and the doctors suggested different creams that might help her grow her hair back. When these didn't work as planned, Alyssa decided to work on her inner self, and then her outer self.
I guess throughout this hair thing, I was like, why is this happening to me? And I turned to God and, like, asking him why this was happening to me.
The first day Alyssa came to school with a bald head, her friends were shocked. Most of them had never seen a girl so young with such a bald head. But once they saw how confident she was and how she walked around school as if nothing happened, they felt differently.
I was, like, really impressed. I don't know a lot of people that can do that, but she has a good head for it.
I don't know. Like, hair is, like, a really simple thing, but it is, like, such a big part of who you are. And I just thought, like, how, like, strong she was to, like, be able to do that.
And I just remember being really impressed how she was able to just, like, put her worries aside and just, like, spend a weekend in fellowship.
Like, she's so amazing, and she kind of, you know, in her words, she rocks her bald.
When Alyssa walks around with her bald head, people often assume she has cancer. This is really annoying to her. But her church and her faith help her deal with this and not let it get to her. When homecoming came around to help her feel more comfortable, Alyssa wore a wig while all the other girls did their hair. She wants to make people feel comfortable around her. So to lighten the mood, she plays tricks on people and brings them into her world.
When I first meet people, you know, I'm usually wearing my hair, but then if it gets hot, I'd like take it off and people are like, what? Like, it just confuses them kind of. And sometimes I hide it in weird places and, like, hang it on the wall. And so people, like, wake up in the morning and they see, like, just this hair on the wall. It's, like, pretty freaky.
Alyssa isn't shy about what's happening to her and encourages people to ask questions.
I love it when people ask me what's really going on instead of making assumptions about what's going on and then feeling sorry for me.
Alyssa's newfound acceptance sometimes worries her family because they think maybe she isn't dealing with it.
They sent me to a therapist to see if I was in denial about my disease because my parents thought I was, like, too passive about it. And when they asked my parents to leave the room, he said,
do you think you have this disease? And I was like, yeah, of course I do. And he's like, well, why aren't you sad about it? I said, why do I have to be sad about it? Like, I have so much more going on. And, you know, like, all this does is make me lose my hair. I'm not a different person.
Today, Alyssa walks around Inglemoore High School proud and confidently.
The first time I saw it, I said, okay, I have a choice. I can either let this make me really sad, or I can make myself really happy from this. And it's not like there weren't bad days. Of course there were bad days. But what I realized is that the only person that I need to be better than was the person I was yesterday. Because honestly, this isn't something you should pity me for. Like, I consider this one of the greatest experiences that have ever happened to me.
Alyssa's hair defied all odds and has even grown back into a little pixie cut, a far cry from her old bald head. Still, she lives every day knowing that her hair could fall out from one day to the next, and she's fine with that, continuing to rock her bald. For Radioactive, I'm Nalwan DeLeal.
Nalwan DeLeal is a junior at Inglemoore High School, and she created this story for Radioactive, KUOW's youth media program. You can apply for this program. The summer workshop is open now. It's a hands-on opportunity to learn how to make radio stories, open to youth age 16 to 18, and it is a paid opportunity. Applications due on May 13th. You can find them at kuow.org/radioactive. So that's the sound of two adult bald eagles having breakfast out on an old pier, chatting with one of their offspring who just landed next to them. You can hear some songbirds chiming in the background. There they are. Our listener Crystal recorded the sound on the south end of Maury Island. What songs are you hearing? Record 30 seconds of them and send it to us along with the story behind the sound. Email it to weekday@kuow.org. Include sound of the day in the subject line.
I'm Bernard Ouellette, NPR News headlines just a minute away. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital H. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.